This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin DNR conservation biologist joins us with the discovery of native mussels believed to be over 100 years old. Now, the Wisconsin Hospital Association last week reported the highest number of COVID-19 hospitalizations so far this year. COVID-19 hospitalizations in Wisconsin are at levels they haven't been since late last year, before vaccines were available. In some cases, hospitals have had to turn patients away. Things are especially bad in northwestern parts of the state. In the northwestern region, as of last week, there were zero intensive care unit beds available. Things didn't look much better in the rest of the state, with just 32 ICU beds in southeast Wisconsin and 14 in south central Wisconsin. We're talking about the current wave of COVID and how it's affecting hospitals. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced delays in care at a Wisconsin hospital during the pandemic? Do you work in healthcare? How have staffing shortages and high demand for your services affected your work? How are you feeling at this stage in the pandemic? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Madeline Heim is a health and science reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Madeline, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you talked to, in a recent piece, Madeline, people with hospitals around the state. It seems like a pretty consistent message. They're seeing, they're at pretty full capacity, right?
Yeah, things are definitely not looking good, and that is something that's happening all across the state. It's not just in, you know, one hospital or two hospitals or a region. We're seeing a lot of the same problems basically everywhere, and that is stemming from, you know, an increasing number of COVID patients, as well as other patients who are trying to seek care that they might have put off during the pandemic. So there's really just kind of a confluence of a couple problems that are leading to this. And then, you know, on the back end as well, we're seeing not only hospitals full, but also nursing homes. And when people need to be released from the hospital to go rehabilitate at a nursing home, a lot of the hospitals are struggling to find nursing homes that will be able to take them. And so I think that's causing a bottleneck on the back end of hospitals as well.
What's that meaning for hospitals' ability to take patients, in some cases, requests from other hospitals to take on more patients?
Yeah, so that's a big problem that they're seeing as well, especially for larger hospitals. Those are usually the ones who are taking requests from smaller hospitals to accept patients that need more specialty care, and we're just seeing that they cannot take those requests. I talked to someone who works with Gunderson Health in western Wisconsin, and she said that in October they fielded over 300 calls from smaller hospitals and other hospitals looking to transfer, and they weren't able to accept any of those patients because they're just so full up themselves. And that's really causing a burden on these smaller hospitals too, because they're used to being able to send patients to these larger hospitals when they need more intense care. And that's just so much harder right now than it usually is.
Now, what did hospital administrators tell you about a vaccination status of the COVID patients they're finding in their emergency rooms?
Yeah, that it's largely unvaccinated patients. You know, definitely not all. We are seeing some breakthrough cases and hospitalizations, but they're saying that the large majority is unvaccinated folks at this point.
Is there any sense of light at the end of the tunnel from the people you talk to?
I wish I could say so. I think right now things do look pretty bad. But, you know, as we've seen throughout the whole pandemic, things do tend to ebb and flow. We did see a decrease, a fairly significant one in hospitals over the summer as more people got vaccinated. And before Delta was on the scene, there was a dip then, and there was a slight dip in late October as well. Unfortunately, we are definitely in a rise right now. And so I'm not sure about the light coming, you know, real quickly, but I do think, you know, eventually we'll get to another period of that dip.
Madeline, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Madeline Heim is a health and science reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. She talked to us about hospitals facing staffing shortages and an influx of patients as we experience another rise in COVID cases and hospitalizations. Now we're taking a look at the latest COVID news. Dr. Dan Shirley is an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Shirley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, can you talk about the COVID patterns, the Delta variant, and the other things that are driving this, what sounds like a significant increase in COVID patients in our intensive care units?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, all over the state, there's an increase in cases. This is Delta primarily that we're still dealing with, and it has to do with lots of things, vaccination rates and just generally people being out and about more, interactions and that type of stuff.
What are you looking at as you look at hospitals' ability to deal with this rise in the number of patients and this limited capacity in intensive care units?
Well, as was mentioned before, this has kind of a domino effect. So when more patients come with COVID, it fills up hospitals. And even if that isn't directly into the bigger hospitals like UW Health, we get a certain amount of transfers from other hospitals, and then eventually bigger hospitals are full as well, which creates this bottleneck. I think the other problem is when patients get sick, really sick with COVID into the ICU, those patients stay in the hospital much longer and require a lot of extra care. So this kind of buildup we've seen before in the pandemic, really what the most important thing to do is try to prevent the admissions in the first place as much as we can.
One thing I want to point out, Madeline reported some of the doctors she talked to said, hey, if you're having a health emergency, don't let this kind of news scare you away from coming to the ER. Can you talk about the importance of seeing to our medical needs, even as we hear these stories, if people are worried about a heart attack or something serious like that?
Right. So that, the concern is that the full hospital will kind of limit the ability to get specialized care or that type of thing. But from a patient's perspective, yes, if you think you're having a medical issue, get to the hospital. We talk about inpatient capacity a lot, but a lot of care can be done in the ED, especially these emergency type things that are, more urgent.
We hear sometimes about number of available beds in hospitals from, zero in some parts of the state to handfuls. But solving that isn't just as easy as adding some furniture. Those beds each require a lot of care and staff. And I understand someone on a ventilator is particularly labor intensive.
Yeah. So like you just said, the, ICUs and ventilator capacity, that's kind of at the last end of all this where, it does require special space and special monitoring and that type of stuff. But, the physical space is one thing, but there's also the need to have enough staff and healthcare workers to care for those people at the different levels of illness. So this is another sort of part of the equation that relates to the capacity issues is healthcare workers availability and just changes over time through this whole pandemic that's been draining on everyone.
You mentioned that the Delta variant right now is driving a lot of our numbers at hospitals, and we have our eye now on this Omicron variant. What are you watching for as we start to piece together more and more information about how it spreads and how severe it is?
Right. So as you know, the first cases were noticed in South Africa, and that was because they have the capability to do the viral sequencing testing to identify it in the first place. And from there, we've noticed cases all over the world, including Wisconsin. And so it does take that specialized ability to do the sequencing, and that takes time to get that ramped up so we can get a good picture of how far it's spread. The next kind of things that happen that we're seeing in the labs in various locations is some of the testing to try to figure out, do these mutations we see actually reflect in increased transmissibility or a change in severity of illness or have an influence on the vaccine effectiveness? The newest thing today is that some of those initial lab-based tests about the vaccine effectiveness or how much antibody neutralization they can see in a test tube, some of those studies have started, but really we won't know much more about the vaccine effectiveness until we see it, what happens in actual human cases.
Can you talk a little more about the monitoring for Omicron and the genetic sequencing efforts you mentioned to try to get a closer look at it as it shows up here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think here we're still in the position of doing more testing and that specialized testing to see to try to find more cases. I think now that we have seen it all over the place, we do expect to find more cases. It's just, it's still that Delta is kind of the overwhelming common variant right now. And so it will be looking at some of those people with risk factors for this particular thing, but also just doing this test more on more specimens.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Mark, hi.
Good afternoon. Just calling to offer, an opinion probably a lot of us are feeling that have been vaccinated and are living a responsible life by keeping our masks on in every environment that's possible, keeping our distance from people, and by getting vaccinated both times and a booster. I'm angry. I'm angry at the people in Wisconsin who refuse to listen to the science and get vaccinated. And then when they get COVID, they go to the hospital to rely on the science to get cured, and in the meantime, deny the care that someone in an emergency situation might have who cannot get the services because there are no ICU beds. As far as I'm concerned, if you have COVID-19 because you refuse to get a vaccination, and you're asking somebody who has a heart attack or something, not to get the services they need because you're taking up a bed, that'll take you out of the hospital, send you home with two aspirin. It's tiring that people want the rights, but they don't want to take the responsibility for living responsibly.
Mark, thanks for the call. Of course, Dr. Shirley, a hospital will treat people in that situation. But can you talk to that the front end preventive effort that I think Mark is hoping to see?
Yeah, I think it's there's a lot of room for frustration, but I think there's a few ways to look at this. So an individual has some risk of getting COVID, and then some risk maybe of more or less severe disease. But another way to think about this is that each individual also has the power to protect the people around them. And that's, loved ones and people that you don't even know if they're immune compromised or can't get the vaccine for some reason. So I think there's some power in thinking about the people around you. And that extends into masks in addition to vaccination and some of the other kind of activities that we do.
We're looking at the latest COVID-19 news here in Wisconsin and limited capacity at hospital emergency rooms. Dr. Dan Shirley is with us, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in with your questions, maybe your thoughts or experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about COVID-19, the latest variants making their ways into the U.S.? Do you have experience working in a hospital? Are you a hospital employee now? What are you seeing maybe in your own ER? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with infectious disease expert Dr. Dan Shirley about the latest COVID news here in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences in the healthcare system as a patient, or if you work for a hospital or clinic, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Karen now in Sparta. Karen, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was just saying that I just had a severe asthma attack last week and ended up on a BiPAP machine in an emergency room. And they wanted to admit me, but there were no beds. So the options were to go home against medical advice or stay in the ER overnight.
Wow. Karen, sounds like you're doing okay now. I hope you've recovered.
Yeah, I'm actually a former respiratory therapist, and I have probably 7 attacks a year, so I was okay with going home. But if it was somebody else, if it was their first attack, that would have been awful.
Karen, I'm sorry to hear that, but thank you for sharing your experience. Dr. Shirley, this is obviously not how we want things to work.
Exactly. Over time, that... sort of getting stuck in the ED happens periodically when capacity is stretched. But obviously that's not the optimal place to do all the care, especially if someone's been told they need to be admitted, there are reasons for that. And so to get all of the best, most efficient care, it usually requires the normal pathway through a hospital, which is not staying in the ED for a super long time.
Thank you again for sharing that story. I appreciate it. Let's go to another caller at 800-642-1234. Rachel is with us in Waterford. Rachel, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to bring up, Rachel? Yep, we can hear you.
Yeah, I just want to bring up about natural immunity. I wonder if your person could talk about, I don't often hear anything in the media about folks that have recovered from COVID and their natural immunity and how that protects them against future infection, since those that have been vaccinated can also get COVID again. I don't often hear about natural immunity.
Rachel, thanks for that question. And that's a big part of the question and a big question about Omicron too, Dr. Shirley. What do we know about immunity for people, as Rachel says, who have had COVID?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that whether you had COVID-19 infection or you got vaccinated, there is the possibility down the road to get reinfected or infected after a vaccine. What we know is that we have a lot of data about what happens when someone gets vaccinated and because of trials and experience. We know less about what happens after an infection as far as immunity. We do follow that, but it's much more unpredictable. So they found that, milder cases result sometimes in less levels of immunity or lower antibody levels. And very severe cases obviously are dangerous in their own right. So somewhere in the middle, it might be that you have immunity that lasts several months. But that unpredictability makes for the advice of getting vaccinated after you've had infection. As far as the timing of that, that needs more study. Right now, the recommendation, because of all that unknown stuff, is to get vaccinated when you recover. But it might be that the optimal time is after some period of time after infection. How that all relates to Omicron is that there's unknowns in that realm too. So if you had past infection with Delta or some other variant, it's really not clear what's going to happen if this Omicron is more widespread. That goes for people that had, their two-shot vaccine series, 6 months ago or more, which is why the recommendation now is, if you're qualified for a booster, to get that. That's the best thing we can do related to vaccine in preparation for Omicron.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Dr. Dan Shirley, assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest COVID-19 related news. Not a lot of capacity in hospital emergency rooms, related in large part to COVID-19. I want to take a little bit, Dr. Shirley, to talk about some new treatments, potentially promising ones in the works, antiviral pills targeting the virus that causes COVID-19, a few expected to be on the market fairly soon. What are they? How do they work?
Right. So the first one that is kind of expected to come down the pike and is in that process that we all know so well about going through FDA approvals is a drug that essentially interrupts the viral replication through kind of working its way in there and causing mutations so that it doesn't replicate properly and then dies. That drug requires, a few pills a couple times a day for 5 days. But the tricky part with both antivirals is that it requires that you have COVID pretty quickly. So it requires early testing once you have symptoms and then getting a prescription quickly. And all of those logistics are pretty complicated. So what we in healthcare are doing right now is trying to work through how will this work when these come about and who really qualifies if there's a short supply or if there's a wide supply, how are we going to do this functionally? The second pill works a little differently in that it actually interferes with viral replication in a different way. But it also has a few complicated things in that it is combined with another drug that might have some drug interactions. So long story short, there's just some logistical issues in getting this to where it's readily accessible to people.
And how about the timing of taking these medications? I want to dig into that a little more. My limited understanding is you got to get the diagnosis and get it kind of at the right phase in the illness. Do I have that right?
Exactly. So, it needs to be sort of outpatient, so mild to moderate COVID. You need to have confirmed diagnosis, which requires a test. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you need to figure out a way to get a prescription and get the drug all within kind of 5 days. So, that's not impossible. We have lots of things that are like that. But, it's just that it's new and we need to work through that process. In addition, what we're talking about is similar to vaccines in that we get emergency use authorization. But whether this is like monoclonal antibodies where it's housed at a hospital and you sort of need to access it that way, or if it's widely available through pharmacies all over, those questions are not quite answered.
In just our last minute or so, what are you watching for as far as what's on the horizon on the treatment side of things for COVID-19?
Well, inpatient treatment is pretty similar as it has been. We have some tools. I think, like you mentioned, these oral antivirals are coming down the pike. We still have monoclonal antibodies, and more of those are getting kind of studied and approved in different formats. So along with kind of treatment of people that are diagnosed with COVID for those new antivirals and monoclonal antibodies, there's also studies going on about that you can get these if you're exposed and maybe prevent either disease or severe disease. So that's, that kind of stuff, along with more rapid testing and, increased vaccination, are really the tools we have in addition to all the other stuff we always talk about masking and distancing.
Dr. Shirley, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Dan Shirley is an assistant professor in the Division of Infectious Disease at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about the Omicron variant and other COVID news, including limited capacity at hospitals around Wisconsin, according to data from the Wisconsin Hospital Association. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about some of the biggest issues in national politics, and you can join in the conversation yourself if you'd like. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. We have some pop culture in the works for tomorrow with a look at TV sitcoms centered around families, a long tradition in the world of television. A new survey asked people, which sitcom family would you want to be part of? And which one are you glad you're not part of? We'll want to hear your answers to those questions, and you can get started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Would you feel at home with the Keatons of Family Ties, the Belchers from Bob's Burgers, or, well, the list goes on and on? You can choose from programs past or present. Or if there's one you like to watch but wouldn't really want to sit down at the table with, let us know that too. Go over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll share some of your answers. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the recycling market took a hit in recent years with low prices of some materials, but it's bounced back, giving a boost to local programs. We'll find out what it all means for recycling in your community. Now, researchers with Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the National Park Service, and the University of Minnesota found a cluster of endangered mollusks they believe to be over 100 years old. These spectacle-case mussels live in the St. Croix River, which forms part of the border between Wisconsin and Minnesota and feeds into the Mississippi. We're learning more about the rare species and the role it plays in the ecosystem. Lisi Kitchell is a conservation biologist for the Wisconsin DNR. Lisi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you bet.
Well, introduce us first to this mussel, please. Could you describe it and tell us why it's so rare?
Well, the spectacle case is called that because when the old pearl button clammers named them back in the 1800s, they thought that the shape of the shell reminded them of that case that you'd put your spectacles in back then. When it's full grown, it's 8 to 9 inches long, and it's kind of shaped a little like an eyeglass case that you might find today, which are called clamshell cases. But so that's why it got named as such. They tend to be a mussel that has always been rare in the sense that they're found in a habitat that's not commonly searched for mussels. And in recent years, they have significantly declined to about half their range. And even in the range where they do occur, they're not that common. So it's a rare species. It's both state and federally listed. And it was nice to find this population above the St. Croix Falls Dam.
How do you spot a rare mussel species in a river? What do you do to go out and find these guys?
Well, normally you'd go out and you'd grub along the bottom looking for the mussels that are there. And fortunately for this species, it tends not to be out in the main river in the bottom of the main river like the rest of the mussels are. It tends to occur in these what I call hidey holes in rock piles. So these are not rock, small rocks. These are big boulders and big slabs of rock that are have areas where the rock is piled up, and then there's crevices in between those rocks, and that's where these guys hide. And you really can't see them from outside, so you actually have to reach in and see if and try to find them in there. Sometimes they're under the edges of really big boulders, so you might be able to see those, but you really have to go looking for them. They're not as obvious as the mussels that occur in the majority of the river.
You mentioned in the St. Croix River, this find was north of the dam there, a key dam. And that's an important part of the story as to why they're endangered, especially in a place like this. Why does the dam affect their life cycle?
Well, these guys were, the fact that they were still alive was pretty surprising. They were well over 100 years old because an important link for our native freshwater mussels is that they have to actually have a fish host to complete their life cycle. And not all mussels will use all fish. These guys tend to use the moon eye and the gold eye. And those fish were blocked from getting to that upper part of the St. Croix River once the dam, St. Croix Falls Dam, was built in 1907. So that's a very migratory, those fish are highly migratory species. So they would, before the dam was built, they would get up through the Cascading Falls and go further upstream. Once the dam was built, they could no longer get upstream. So the important piece with these guys was that the population downstream of the dam still has gold eye and moon eye present and can reproduce and complete their life cycles. But the ones above the dam could no longer reproduce. I mean, they could go ahead and make sperm and eggs, but they, without having the fish host to complete their life cycle, they couldn't complete their reproduction.
How can you tell if a mussel is over 100 years old?
Well, the way you age mussels is not unlike the way you age trees, in that they put down an annuli every year. They go down in the substrate in the winter, and then when they come back up in the spring, then there's a margin, that shell margin is darkened, and then the new growth is lighter. So you can actually look at those rings just like trees. Huh. But the problem with these guys were two things. One, when they're that old, the growth rings are right next to each other, so they're very hard to distinguish. But more importantly, the shells were eroded, again, because they were so old. And so you really couldn't see those external rings. So what we did was we saved some of the dead shells that we found along with alive individuals, and we will cross-section through those shells and then be able to actually count the annuli by seeing those without the erosion on the outside of the shell. And so we estimated their age just based on the fact that even if these guys were born the day the dam was built, they had to be at least 114 years old, and they're more than likely 120, possibly 130 years old.
Talking to Lacey Kitchell from the Wisconsin DNR about a rare species of mussel in Wisconsin rivers. These spectacle case mussels, what role do they play in a river ecosystem?
Well, they, along with all the other mussels that live in the river, are truly our aquatic engineers. They are our water filter systems. They, each individual mussel can filter 10 gallons or more a day, and you have mussel beds with hundreds and sometimes thousands of mussels in them. So they're really filtering our water. They're taking out contaminants. They're taking out some of the sediment that's there. So they're really significant contributors to the water quality. In the St. Croix, you have good water quality, but these guys are ensuring that that water quality continues. So that's their primary ecological contribution, although they do take things that are in the water column, they concentrate that down, and then they excrete that. So the other things that live on the bottom, like the bugs and the crayfish, they make that food available to them as well, which wouldn't be available from the water column.
As we wrap up, what are the DNR and partners doing to try to protect, maybe even grow back the mussel population?
Right. Well, we are propagating spectacle case at the Genoa National Fish Hatchery and at the Minnesota Propagation Facility. However, without the fish host above the dam, it's not worth putting mussels up there if they can't complete their life cycle. Below the dam, there are fairly good population of spectacle case, and we're actually propagating them so we can put them out in rivers where we've lost that species, but we still have the fish host. So the ones above the dam, unfortunately, unless we can get the fish hosts up there, which is unlikely, the prospect for them does not look good.
Lisi, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Lisi Kitchell is a conservation biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She was with us today to share the discovery of 100-plus-year-old mussels in the St. Croix River. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story from 2020 about someone bringing a community together by building boats.
Birch bark canoes take a long time to make, but master artist Wayne Vallier from the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, tells us that the process is just as important as the finished project. And he should know. Vallier was just selected to be a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment of the Arts, one of the top honors in folk and traditional art. Mackenzie Martin with WXPR in Rhinelander brings us the story. It's part of their Curious North series.
In early August, master artist Wayne Vallier started working with apprentices in Lac du Flambeau to build a birch bark canoe.
Hello, we're back. We're still in Wayne's garage.
Throughout the canoe's construction, the process was live streamed on the Waswaganing Indian Bull Facebook page.
And they're working on the ribs to go on the inside of the canoe, so let me turn this around.
The project was part of a larger grant from the First Nations Development Institute.
Wayne Vallier, master canoe builder, teaching us how to do this.
All right, let's push another one, right here.
My name is Wayne Vallier. My native name is Good Sky. As far as Ojibwe canoe builders, there are only five master builders left in the Midwest.
And two of the five master Ojibwe canoe builders left happen to be in Lac du Flambeau. It's Wayne and his brother, Leon.
Pushing this down here.
Wayne Vallier has now made over 30 canoes in different communities, and he thinks something that's really important about this work is the way it's able to connect people from different areas.
That connection of the high-end canoe is one that the Anishinaabe brought from the eastern seaboard. It connects the Ottawas, the Potawatomis, and the Ojibways together.
What does it mean to still be doing this work and to not only be doing this work, but to be training a younger generation on how to do this?
It makes me feel close to my ancestors. It's a responsibility of the older artists of my age to do this for the next generation so that our culture lives on. By knowing where you've been, you'll have a better understanding and where you're going.
Vallier believes that the more people they include in the building of the canoe, the more experiences they have represented in the canoe.
We tried to have as many different hands touching these canoes as possible. What happens is people imprint part of their life essence into these canoes. they put a few stitches, and that few stitches stays there for a long time. It becomes very powerful. So at the end of all of that, all the sweat and the life that's happening around these canoes, something very beautiful comes out of it.
He says you can think of the entire process as a reminder of the benefits of teamwork. Like, by itself, the birch bark is weak, the spruce root that ties the whole thing together is fragile, and the pitch that seals the canoe is easily manipulated.
But when you put all of these things together and they work in sync, the canoe becomes very strong, so strong that a person could take a hammer and beat on the side of one of these canoes and you're not going to pierce a hole in it. The teaching is, when we stand alone, we are weak. But when we stand together, we're very strong.
Another takeaway, creating something strong takes time.
WXPR's Mackenzie Martin brought us that story as part of their Curious North series. It's a lot like WPR's Wisconsin Project, where we answer audience questions in Wisconsin Life segments. To submit your question, go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, prices for recyclable goods have been way up lately. That means more funding for recycling centers around Wisconsin. We'll learn more about how this all works from the state's Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. According to the Wisconsin DNR, just 2 years ago, there was a crisis in recycling. Less demand for recycled materials meant challenging times for facilities that process recyclables from consumers. Now the situation has turned around. The department last month reported record high values for recycled materials. Jennifer Semrau is the Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR's Waste and Materials Management Program. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is happening with recycled good prices right now?
Yeah, well, as we mentioned in our press release, we're really happy to report that pricing is up. And as you noted, that has not always been the case. We did have a couple of years where pricing for recyclable commodities was rather depressed, but we've seen an increase in demand over this past year, and that's been reflected in increased pricing.
Let's look at the why behind both parts of the story. Let's go back a couple years to, say, 2019. You know, we heard China wasn't going to take some kinds of recycled material anymore. What was going on that was driving down these prices and creating trouble for recycling facilities?
Sure. Yeah, you really hit it on the head that some of the markets that the United States used to rely upon, like China and other Southeast Asian countries, started closing their doors to recyclables from the United States. And the reason that they did that is because we weren't sending them high quality recyclables. There was too much trash and non-recyclable materials in those loads that were going overseas. And so they just really became much more strict on what they would accept and set higher contamination limits. I should say lower contamination limits. But as a result of that, it told the United States, well, we need to improve our domestic marketplace. And so that's somewhat what has happened over the past couple of years since.
I was wondering about that. Is this spike, we had this record about a month ago in a lot of key prices, is it because of a long-term improvement in demand, or is there some sort of like COVID-related spike going on here?
It really is both. I mean, on the plastic sides, we see a lot of COVID impact, if you will. There's a lot of single-use items that have become more prevalent with COVID. And so that's where we're seeing a bit of the plastic increasing. And I guess also you could say on the fiber side as well, because so many of us are having items shipped to our home. We used to shop in person much more, and now instead we're having items shipped to our homes, and that's been increasing the demand for cardboard.
Talking to Jennifer Semrau, Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR's Waste and Materials Management Program, talking about an upswing in just the last 2 years in the prices of recycled products, helping local facilities. Okay, so what does this jump in prices, Jennifer, mean for, you know, municipalities, counties, local governments who run recycling programs?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, for some programs, this has enabled them to take on some capital projects that they've had to put on hold. I've spoken to some facility operators across the state that have been able to add some equipment, things that like an eddy current that helps separate aluminum, adding additional optical sorters and robotics. So really trying to improve their facilities, taking advantage of these extra commodity values. And others, you know, frankly, you know, ran a deficit and are now able to add back into that, you know, rainy day fund to ensure that when markets dip, which they do, markets do go up and down, that they'll have those funds that they need for future operations.
Big picture, how much material gets diverted into recycling in Wisconsin, meaning it doesn't end up in a landfill instead?
Sure, you bet. Our latest figures are from 2020, you know, last year, and that year we recycled 750,000 tons of materials. And I do want to point out that that's really just from residential and some commercial entities. We don't actually collect data on all of the recycling activity that happens in the state. So for instance, there is some commercial recycling that may go directly to a paper mill because we have such a strong paper industry in Wisconsin. So we only collect data from those recycling processors. We call them material recovery facilities, and they're the ones who report to us. So even just with that subset of the recycling activity, 750,000 tons last year.
I know from one community to another, there's a lot of variation in what you can and can't recycle. Do you see trends, Jennifer, in more communities being able to take and use particular types of material or getting away from particular materials?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you are correct. It does vary across the state on what you can or cannot recycle. But that being said, there is a universal list of items that can be recycled everywhere. So cardboard boxes, milk jugs, aluminum cans, steel cans, glass bottles, and paper can be recycled everywhere in the state. Where it does get a bit more tricky is in other types of plastic materials. So when you get away from, say, soda bottles, milk bottles, and detergent bottles, then, you know, it really does vary across the state. To answer your question, yeah, we are seeing an increase, though, in programs that can accept some additional plastics, such as dairy containers and like deli containers.
Is there some good general advice you have for, you know, us people in how we recycle to make things easier in our local facility and make sure it ends up saving money for the local government?
Sure. I guess one piece of advice is not to wish cycle. That is actually a term that we use in the industry, where when a person isn't sure if something's recyclable, but you just really hope it is. So you're wishing for it to be so and putting it in your recycling container. Checking locally is just the best advice I can give. Every local government in Wisconsin is required to do some recycling education. So they should know, you know, what you can recycle at your local program. And so just checking if you're not sure on a particular item, instead of guessing, you know, one way or the other, is really the best way to go.
Speaking of wishes, a lot of people making their wish lists for holiday shopping right now. Any thoughts to share with us on recycling for all the materials that come along with a holiday like Christmas?
Yeah, you bet. Again, as I mentioned, cardboard can be recycled everywhere across the state of Wisconsin. So all of those boxes that you may have gotten your holiday presents in, break them down. They take up a lot less space in your cart as well as in the recycling truck if you can break down those boxes. And again, you can recycle those anywhere in the state. But other things like wrapping paper, that's going to be one of those examples that you need to check locally. Some programs will take wrapping paper that doesn't have any glitter or foil, things like that. But others can't take it at all depending on their facility operations. So one other piece of advice, keep the bows and the ribbons out. Nowhere in Wisconsin are those recyclable, so save them for next year.
Now, when we wave by to our recycling carts, are we going to see this stuff again? Do these recycled products end up in goods that we end up using down the road?
Absolutely. I mentioned our paper industry, and so that's just really a great example. The vast majority of paper that's recycled by residents in Wisconsin stays in Wisconsin and goes to Wisconsin paper mills. So depending on what type of mill it is, you know, for instance, a tissue mill that makes napkins, toilet paper, paper towels, things of that nature, you truly couldn't be using something that you recycled in the past in a product that you're buying today.
What are you watching for, just in our last few moments, Jennifer, with future trends? We saw a low to a high when it came to these prices. What are you watching for now?
Sure. I mean, it's natural to expect that we'll see a slight decline. Again, over time, recycling markets are a wave up and down over time. So I do expect prices to dip a little bit, but I also do not expect us to go down to the values that we saw a couple of years ago where, you know, certain commodities were not worth you know, much more than $0 a ton. So I think we can expect some positive markets going into 2022.
Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Semrau is the DNR Waste Reduction and Diversion Coordinator. We talked to her about the low and then the high in values of recycled materials. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get a bonus edition of the WPR podcast mapped out, looking at the past and future of our political boundaries. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then raising the debt ceiling and passing a big social safety net and climate change package. Those are just two of the things Democrats in Congress are trying to get done before the end of the year. We'll find out what's moving forward, what's stuck, and more in our weekly look at the top stories in Washington. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.